Accession number 24193, Reel 9.
Mr. Tao, Reel 9. We were talking about the defensive positions in Sami Chon Valley, which you had taken up with eight platoon of C Company, 1st Battalion Royal Norfolks. And you said the key to the position was the barbed wire.
All around the perimeter of the defensive position, there were layers and layers, or lines and lines, of barbed wire. And most activity, when one was not either fighting or on patrol, or digging, was wiring. Unfortunately, wiring has to be done in daylight, and you were exposed, and the enemy would quite often mortar or shell wiring parties. And you imagine it, a bale of wire, barbed wire, weighs 50 to 60 pounds, brought up by the Korean porters, together with the twisted stakes, which then were turned as a screw into the ground with a sort of big iron bar. And then with gloves and wire cutters, which were always in short supply, these great drums of barbed wire were then unraveled and stretched to the next iron picket and the next iron picket. And until you'd gotten the length you wanted to do, and then you returned at a different height on the same picket until you had probably four levels of barbed wire. And then you went either forward or back, depending where you started from, to connect again with barbed wire. So you'd set a parallel line of barbed wire, which you would fill, having set up your fence, as it were, with coils of barbed wire, which are also brought up by the Korean porters. And then you would link in make sure the integrity of the barbed wire defense was tough. You would link these all together. So it was quite formidable. And then you'd start another belt and another belt, subject to A, the time, the enemy disposition, because you didn't want to risk lives. And in some cases, you could only get a line, let's say 10 yards of barbed wire fencing. In some cases, you'd have 50 yards of barbed wire fencing. And that was your main defense. And that would be as close as 5 yards in front of your firing position.
Now, how did that square with patrolling?
Well, you had exits in the platoon position, and you would weave your way through a complicated path through the wire. It was never straight. It was very zigzagged, and people delighted in making maze-like constructions so that all the platoon knew where the turns were, but visitors would not. And they were at the back. The wire went all the way around, because a Chinese tactic is to attack from the rear often and bypass you in the front. So it wasn't just the shop window you were concerned with. And ultimately you dug individual weapon pits at the back, but not a communication trench, because it was just too much work. And the soil and granite was very tough and very hard work. And there was scrub, which was difficult to chop down, and often you met...
What was the vegetation like, generally?
It was low-lying. Being a very cold place in winter, it was low, tough, shrub-like oak scrub, is the best way of going. 3 feet, 4 feet high. And then, of course, you got on some of the major hills, nothing at all. It was just sheer granite because it was too cold. It was very, very, very cold winters there.
Well, let's move on to the winter, because you were running right into winter, November, yes. December, January.
The winter was a very serious part of our life. You couldn't, for example, touch bare metal without gloves because you'd lose your skin. Your skin would stick to it. You couldn't... your water in your water bottle would freeze solid probably within an hour or so. So all of this had to be kept in your dugout. Let's call it a dugout, which is probably the best overall description, to try and keep it warm. there were very few trees. It was either a question of what flat area there was rice paddies, and the rest, or vegetables, or cattle, oxen, and so on, and the rest were impenetrable scrub, thorn, bushes, very few trees, although there were patches of pine, but they weren't common, and then nothing on top of the very high hills. Difficult country to hide in, except in the sense that you could hide in the folds in the rock. It made mortar shells landing very lethal, because there wasn't much soil for it to bury itself in and then explode. So they were very dangerous because they just exploded.
I will come back. But how did you counter the extreme cold?
We all arrived in Korea with sort of summer-like clothing, and the Americans fortunately clothed us with parkas, great thick parkas that folded up between your legs, a big heavy coat and hood and gloves. We wore white over the top of that. In snow, you would have a white smock, trousers and blouse, which rendered you virtually invisible against the snow. You had heavy snow, you had bitter cold, strong winds, and summer, of course, was very hot.
Okay. Yeah. How did you... could you heat the dugout or the...
Heating, most command centre was heated, and it was heated by petrol dripped through a system of handmade stoves with an inverted gasoline jerry can dripping gasoline into a fire which burnt, and they were called, there is a word for them, which I have just forgotten, but it did keep you warm, but the supply of gasoline wasn't good, and it was quite erratic and also quite dangerous.
Because you
had to have a chimney, and somebody could drop a grenade down the chimney. And secondly, the gasoline was quite likely to explode, and there were some accidents. But the method of keeping warm was you would allow soldiers in to come into the dugout, the command center, to get warm. And once they were warm, and they were not on duty, i.e. on stand two, and there were levels of stand two. They would then go to their dugout and then try and sleep, having been warm. We'd make hot water on the stove, and that would be put in water bottles, which would enable them to get back to their dugout and have a little warmth for some while. They would have a ground sheet would cover the dugout, so it would create a fug inside to a degree. In the trench, when you were
I think now it's probably a good time to start looking at a typical day's routine, okay, which will pick up all these things like stand two. So how would your day start?
Right, you'd start at dawn, about half an hour before dawn. There was a regiment, a battalion-wide, and I think across the United Nations line, a standard stand two at dawn, probably half an hour before dawn. That meant that all soldiers occupied their firing position, all radios were switched on, all people were at their war positions. Stand two generally would last an hour or two, and provided there was no enemy activity, you would then scale down the stand two, again according to a formula, and it had different names, I can't remember what those names are, but you'd have 75% stand two, you'd have a 50% stand two, you'd have a 25% stand two. The latter would be when there was absolutely no activity, but that wiring, enemy activity, but that wiring would be taking place, or digging would be taking place. And these people, the one in four, would be watching for enemy activity whilst the wiring was in progress, or whilst the digging was in process. So the front was always being watched. After that, you would then have breakfast tea.
Would you set sentries on? I mean, was there a sentry level?
Yes, and that's what I'm really referring to the scale down, stand to. And that would be, the minimum would be one in four. The maximum would be...
That was the minimum?
Yes, absolutely.
After stand two?
After stand two, you would then, again, with the level of stand two being observed, you would then go to the rear of the feature, which you hope was unobserved, where tea would have been brewed or would be being brewed, and soldiers would then have hot tea, would do their ablutions if they, it wasn't too cold, and have breakfast. We lived on American sea rations, which were packs, cardboard packs, with probably four tins, corned beef hash, beans with pork. Tiny, tiny, tiny square centimetre of pork per tin. Cigarettes, which you traded for food if you didn't smoke. Biscuits, cheese, soap, matches, sanitary paper, and some sweets or chocolate bar or something.
So these were like the British compo boxes,
yes,
in the Second World War.
Yes, absolutely.
Except they were American.
Except they were all American, yes.
Did the food in it match with English tastes of the time? Tastes have changed.
I think everybody just ate it and got on with it. And, you know, it wasn't bad. Beans and pork was baked beans. And you ate that out of the tin with your plastic spoon, which was in it. And you look for the little piece of pork at the bottom, and you ate that. Corned beef hash.
Would you get them heated?
Yes. You inside the container was a little tiny form of... I think it was a... It may have been a candle now. I can't remember. It was a primus with paraffin in it, and that was lit, and a little tiny stand, and which you shielded from the wind, and you put your container, your can on it.
Like a Tommy cooker from...
Yes, that's right. And you ate from the can. The trick was not to burn it at the bottom, so you stirred it a bit. Some dishes were very good. I liked the baked beans, the beans and pork. I liked the corned beef hash, which was very good. But there was some other disgusting stuff, like spaghetti with something. And it was that sort of wheat-type product. I would trade my cigarettes, and you had a pack of 20, probably Lucky Strike.
20 a day?
Yes, a day. And the batman or signaller used to do all this, and there'd be a sort of stock market rate, you know. For one packet of cigarettes, you might get... corned beef hash was more highly regarded than beans and pork. So you might get half a corned beef hash can for your 20. Therefore, you'd wait 2 days to get it. And my batman or signaller used to keep a very good book. And I'm sure he got a broker's fee on this. But it worked very well indeed. So we ate that for lunch.
This, all the food would be heated on your Tommy cooker?
Absolutely.
Nothing was prepared by cooks?
No. There were no cooks at all in each platoon location, or in each company location. Although the company headquarters was generally slightly back, but not a long way back, 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, back from the line. And there the company sergeant major, being sergeant majors, probably would have a little central fire and would have a larger container of tea for the company headquarters and visitors, because we'd go to the company headquarters from time to time, and there'd always be a cup of tea there, and it was very popular for you to be accompanied by a signaller or somebody who would change roles to get a cup of tea. But we had no central heating or eating of that sort, and now, really no washing either.
Well, let's talk about washing, because you said they'd go back for, you know, for the, they'd pick up their food and they'd, they'd also attend to their ablutions. What about, firstly, the latrines? What latrine arrangements were there?
There were. We would dig latrines on the reverse slope and try to sandbag them if we could.
What pattern
they were
they?
Open. They were absolutely open to the elements. They'd hoped to have a sort of sandbag screen, more for enemy action than decency. We used to try and be fussy at the beginning to have an officer's and another rank's latrine, but to be quite frank, there was only one officer, and that seemed an unnecessary waste of time. And I think the trick was always to try and get to the latrine first in the morning, because it would be in a better shape then than it would be later on in the day.
Was it a pole, or was it actually a seat?
It was a hole, and there was a wooden something to sit on. I'm sure it wasn't pre-designed. I think they were cut out of boxes. I'm sure they were quite basic.
And what about the washing facilities? You said there weren't
There weren't any. You had your water out of your water bottle, which you cooked with your cooker, again, and you got hot water. But if you shaved, which everybody had to shave, when you shaved, you had to be very quick because the water would freeze solidly very quickly, even from a boil.
So you did have to shave.
Yes.
Why was that enforced? I mean,
I think it was enforced because it made us feel cleaner, better organized, more efficient, and more disciplined. The lucky man was the pioneer platoon sergeant, a headquarter unit, which laid mines and did other things of that. And did small engineering projects, like if we needed to blow up a rock to continue our slit trench, we'd call the pioneers. They were Royal Norfolk. And the sergeant, by history, was allowed to grow a beard. So he grew his beard and nobody else did. And we were all quite fastidious about our shaving.
What about washing, though? I mean, how much washing could you manage with just...
Well, you washed out of your mess tin. And so you had the debate was, do you shave first or do you wash first? And people had different ideas, because if you shaved, you had a bit of soapy stuff there. I think I shaved first and then washed first, but it was quite basic.
So no chance for a shower or a bath?
When there was no reasonable surety of no enemy action. There was, back with typical American attention to this comfort level, they did have mobile bath and laundry units that visited battalion headquarters or a location central to the battalion, and in turn, and of course you couldn't denude your hill, so you would send a type of stand to, like 50% can go, and you'd have 2 hours to have a complete shower and shave and do all those sort of stuff, and a complete change of underclothes and clothing when it was soiled. That would happen not very often, at best once every 2 weeks.
Were lice a problem?
Yes. And there were other... Yes, lice was a problem. There was another problem of something that gets into the seams of your clothing. Not lice, but it's an issue in the tropics. I just can't remember what it was. But we used to have to spray our clothing to try and eliminate the lice and try and eliminate this particular problem, which I've forgotten, which was rather serious. But basically, it was a sort of chemical, and this was a way of hygiene. But hygiene was a problem. Many of us, I got in Pataigu in the summer for not washing, I think, carefully under the chin. One had great big scars or scabs or ugly looking thing where the treatment was putting a violet ginseng blue or something on it, and that was supposed to make it go away. You could actually have asked for, if you get it badly, you could ask for medical repatriation and you go back to a regimental aid post, by the way, was also at headquarters, where the doctor would be and a couple of orderlies. And you could apply to go to the regimental aid post. You'd be given this Jensen violet cream. And if it was bad, you could be sent back to a further rear echelon field hospital. In Pataigu, skin complaints were a problem. Now, more, of course, in winter, funnily enough, than in summer.
Now, we were sort of going through the daily treatment with side routes, which
yes,
is what I was with.
Yes.
Now, so after you've had your washing and your morning meal,
yes,
then that was at the back of the hill.
That was the back
what
of the hill.
What would happen next?
You would then go back and clean your weapon.
Was that considered important?
Terribly important. And that would happen, you would clean it, you would then have it inspected by the officer or on the hill or the sergeant. So groups would go off, still maintaining a rota of stand two, of sentry, and the corporals were responsible for that within the manpower. And maybe the quarter wasn't always observed, but there'd always be somebody watching the front. And then the rest would clean their weapon and then bring it back. And generally speaking, you would sort of walk out of the communication trench, round the back. People would go over the skyline and yell at them, get off the skyline, because it would be too visible. You would then clean your weapon.
Would you clean your own or would your batman do it?
I would actually clean my own.
And what did you have? Did you have a Sten or a...
I had a 38 caliber pistol, which was really rather useless. I don't think any of us ever fired them. And an officer got a ration of a bottle of whiskey, which he paid for, a week, and three bottles of beer, which one made available, and the sergeant similarly. And so between us, we had enough beer to give the soldiers some beer. The whiskey was often used to trade with the Americans for their weapons. And I put my 38 away and got myself an American 45 automatic, a great big thing. It sounded like a cannon when it was fired. And if you hit anything, you knew it would stop it.
And that was a pistol?
That was an automatic, yes, a pistol that you wore, and you put your 38 away under your bed because it was really so inaccurate and so ineffective. we then went to carrying an American 300 automatic rifle. Not a Garand, not a heavy rifle, but a light magazined rifle. again, one traded that. And I had one of those, and I would fire that. The soldier would not have appreciated, would not be familiar with it. So this weapon that we, the officers, generally carried, which was an American automatic rifle.
Was it a carbine?
It was a carbine, thank you. Yes, I've been thinking of the word, trying to think of the word. he would not have been, the batman or signaller would not have been familiar with that, so I would have cleaned that. He would have prepared my grenades and maintained those. But the soldiers, having had cleaned their weapon, having had it inspected by the sergeant or myself, would then go back. We would then... again, by rota, ask permission to test our weapons from the company commander. And in a quiet sector, this was perfectly all right. And it was much looked forward to by everybody.
And how regular would this be? I mean, was this daily?
Daily. The enemy knew where we were. We weren't trying to hide. And, of course, it was important to range. The Bren gunner, to be sure that he knew that that bush over there was 200 yards away, and he could fire at it and see the dust. The rifleman individually could get the feel of the range. I'll tell a funny story in a moment. So we'd get permission from the company commander to test our weapons. And we'd allocate certain people to test their weapons. So individual ranging would take place. And on a wonderful occasion, during a weapon testing, we were always trying to live off the land, like shooting pheasant, shooting deer, or throwing hand grenades into ponds to eat the fish. And there was a fair amount of wildlife. But on this occasion, in a weapon testing moment, a deer ran across our front line. We'd registered in the past all the ranges. The deer entered our field of fire from the right-hand side of the platoon. People asked permissions, corporal, sergeant asked permission to engage it. I said yes. So rifleman opened up. The deer proceeded from right to left. The Bren gunner opened up. The deer continued from right to left. A two-inch mortar, the two-inch mortar man, each platoon had a two-inch mortar, said, could he range, please? So he fired at the deer. The deer continued to move from right to left. The Vickers machine section and the Sergeant Denny said they too should test their weapons. So we fired, and he fired his machine guns. The deer disappeared off our left flank, seemingly absolutely unhurt, untouched. And incidentally, it went through a minefield laid by our pioneer platoon at in quite recent time. The colonel, the company commander rang up wanting to know what the hell was going on. Are you being attacked? There's a sound of heavy firing. What's the situation? And I had to say, no, we had some faulty weapons we were just clearing. He said, well, that sounded a bit more than that. You better come and tell me about it. I went and told him about it, and he squared it with the colonel. But we didn't hit this damn deer.
Wasn't that a bit worrying? About the accuracy of your...
yes, it was, but it was a very small deer, and one was aiming, really, to fill this valley with fields of fire and so on. One was getting near it, one could see, but generally always behind it, because it was running very fast, and maybe we weren't aiming off enough.